Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, June 4th, 2018, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria, and we have a really good one this week. We're going to talk to preeminent, influential, incredibly talented science writer, Carl Zimmer, about his new book. But before we do, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be, I mean, as long as it exists, which don't worry, we're not going anywhere. It is and will always be 100% free to download. I think it's really, really important that we never charge for this content, that anybody who wants to listen always has the opportunity to do so and to learn more about, you know, the cool science that's happening all around us. But because in many ways, you know, I do this by myself. I do all of the booking. I do the interviewing. I work really hard. And recently, I've been lucky enough now that I'm back in school and continuing with my work in television to be able to hire a bit of help in the form of both an assistant and an editor. You know, I can't do this for free. And so it's really the support from you guys that makes Talk Nerdy possible. I sell ads in some of my episodes. That's a great way to be able to take the burden off of you. But also, I have the show posted on Patreon. And if you're not familiar with Patreon, it's a great community where you can become a patron of all of the different independent creators that you care about. So if you want to support the show on an episodic basis at any amount that makes sense to you, you are helping to take the burden off of others, those who can't afford to give, so that the show is always free to download. You know, similar to like the PBS or the NPR model. So if you're interested, just visit patreon.com/talknerdy. You can dig around on the page and see the different levels that you can support at and some of the freebies that I'll send your way if you do so. Let's go ahead and thank the top patrons this week. And they include all those names that you've grown to really know and love. They include, let's see, David J.E. Smith, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, The Zombie Drummer, Gabriel Felipe Hermio Gonzalez, and Jeffrey Sewell. And I think I have some new ones here. Got to just click through to a different link to see those names. Yes, we've also got Phil T-Bear and Rob Schreck. Welcome, Rob. Thank you so much for your incredible support. All right. Oh, yeah. And I know I keep mentioning the new store on the website. It's coming soon, I promise. Maybe it'll be up by the time this airs. Probably not, though. if you're interested in seeing special merch get thrown up there, just reach out at shoptalknerdy@gmail.com and give me your suggestions. All right. So without any further ado, guys, his name is Carl Zimmer. You have read his writing. You may not know that you've read his writing, but you have absolutely read his writing. He has a regular column at the New York Times. It's called Matter, and he writes incredible stories there. He's also written for almost every outlet you can think of. You know, just every place that you've read any science writing, Carl has written there. He's an adjunct at Yale University teaching science writing, and you've probably also heard his voice on Radiolab because he is a regular contributor, somebody who's interviewed there quite often. He's won countless awards for his work, and he has written 13 different books about science. Science Inc., of course, I love because it's all about cool science tattoos, Parasite Rex, Brain Cuttings, The Planet of Viruses, so many incredible books. But this week, we're going to talk about his brand new book. It's called She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. So without any further ado, here he is, Carl Zimmer. Well, Carl, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I'm really excited to talk about your new book. It is called She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. So I think probably the first question we should ask right at the beginning is, what is heredity? What's the difference between the word heredity and hereditary? Because I think that people get those mixed up quite a lot.
Yeah, and understandably so, because, you know, the word heredity has a long, fascinating history. I talk about this towards the beginning of the book. I mean, it actually starts out in the Roman Empire, hereditas, which was really the transfer of rights from someone who died to someone who inherits them, the heir. And that was the way that people talked about heredity for a long time. But then in the 1700s and 1800s, there was a kind of an interesting shift where people started to say, like, well, are there things that we inherit from our parents, invisible biological things that could explain why some things seem to be carried down through the generations? And so then heredity took on this sort of biological meaning. And that, you know, in the search of answers to that question of what is heredity, you know, genetics was born in the early 1900s.
And of course, we now know through all of those studies from Gregor Mendel. I mean, this was like Darwin didn't even really understand how heredity worked at the time. But like we now know about genes, but we also, I think, are becoming more confident that genes aren't the entire picture. Isn't that right?
Sure. And if you look at the first generation of geneticists, it's really astonishing how eager they were to claim that everything had been worked out. And some some geneticists would say, oh, there is a gene for feeble-mindedness, or there's a gene for shipbuilding, or whatever. It was kind of ridiculous in hindsight.
It's the modern phrenology, really.
It was. But just by studying fruit flies, a biologist like Thomas Morgan could show that, well, actually, for any one trait, there are lots of genes involved, and any one gene can potentially be involved in lots of different traits. So it's more complicated than one gene, one trait. That's a good place to start if you're learning about genetics in high school, but you got to really move beyond that, even just to look at genes in terms of heredity. We can talk about whether there are other kinds of heredity as well.
Like some things that are happening culturally and environmentally. And even before we get to that, I mean, I think probably the hot topic that a lot of people like to bring up is epigenetics, which we'll get to, but we're not even really talking about that kind of new fancy science. We're really just talking about the gene and environment interaction, which is way more complicated than, you're right, your high school genetics textbook would kind of lead you to believe.
Yeah. And you know, just to give one example, I got my genome sequenced while I was working on the book, and I would go visit scientists with this external hard drive, and they would poke around, and we would find some interesting things. So one interesting thing I found is that I have a mutation in both copies of a gene called FTO. It's a pretty common mutation I inherited from my parents on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And that mutation makes people, on average, slightly heavier, a few pounds heavier. And it has to do with how you take calories from your food and turn them into heat or into fat. But actually, if you look at people who were born, say, in the 1940s or earlier, my mutation doesn't have that effect on them. And the reason scientists believe is that the environment has changed. In this case, it's our dietary environment. So we are living in a world that's just awash in calories and carbohydrates and sugar and corn syrup and so on. And when you're putting all that stuff into your body, sort of on average, that leads to people putting on more weight, being at a somewhat higher risk of obesity and so on. But, you know, the diet that people had earlier, in the, you know, mid to early 20th century, just didn't have all those extra calories. And in that environment, this FTO mutation just didn't have that same effect.
Oh, interesting. I wonder if this is the same. You know, I did my 23andMe quite a while ago. And 23andMe, of course, unless you want to take your raw data and use another program like Prometheus, it only gives you a handful of kind of what the law has allowed them to tell you, a handful of little things here and there about both health and just kind of like interesting to know factoids. And one of mine is that some genetic mutation, I don't even know which gene, if you have it, or maybe it's not even a mutation, but if you have it in this certain way, you will have more of a quote athletic body type. I remember it telling me that I should have more of a quote athletic body type. And I was like, yeah,
right.
That didn't happen. That's not me.
I got a result like that from one of these services. And I think the way they put it was, I think they said your muscles are built for power. And I thought anybody who's seen me try to hike a mountain knows that that is not true.
Yeah, right. So it is kind of funny how, you know, a lot of this comes into how these things are interpreted, how much data already exists on that particular gene. Has it been studied, you know, redundantly by multiple scientists? What do they know about it? And of course, 23andMe and different databases like this, not to belittle them, I think they're fascinating. And I actually think that kind of this modern genomic research that brings power to the people is a really interesting and important concept. But their database is limited, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's limited just in terms of, you know, the scientific literature that they can look at. And it's limited in terms of the kind of, you know, diversity of people they're looking at. So, you know, genes can have different effects in people of different ancestry. So when you have these databases, they're really very biased towards, you know, people of European descent. They're not going to be having as much power as they potentially could if they really represented, you know, our whole species.
And of course, that brings me, I think, to a part of the conversation that's super important, a part of the conversation that you actually get into in your book, which is lots of authors, I think, have been kind of worried or afraid of going there because of the potential political ramifications of doing so. And that is the conversation around the basically early genetic movement in the biological sciences, which was basically synonymous in many ways with eugenics. So I remember seeing this really haunting image of a journal. I can't remember which one. Maybe it was like the Annals of Human Genetics Research or something like that. And it was on a bookshelf in a library, you know, the periodical. So you've got the bound journals by the year. And you can see the shift from it being called in, you know, whatever year it was at the early 1900s, the Annals of Human Eugenics or the Annals of Eugenics, and then moving into this more modern title, which was Human Genetics. And it's so interesting to see that the seed of a lot, not all, but a lot of genetics research came from a group of people that had a lot of power, but a very agenda-driven reason for doing their research.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that this is more so the case among people in these areas of science than, I don't know, geologists or astronomers or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think because they were very much studying, you know, human nature. And so they were, you know, educated and brought up with lots of preconceptions about human nature and differences between groups of people and so on. And so that they sort of carry that over into the language of genetics. And then to say like, well, you know, people would claim that blacks were genetically inferior. Now they could use the word genetically to justify a racism that had existed for centuries beforehand, might have been expressed in biblical terms, you know, that, well, Africans inherit the curse of Ham. That's how, you know, a church minister in the American South in the antebellum years would have said it. Now, yeah. Now all of a sudden you can use sort of this genetic language to make it sound more sciencey. But pretending that these things didn't happen, and trying to pretend that, you know, leading geneticists didn't embrace eugenics is just doing a disservice to history. And so you really need to, I think, have to dive in deep because, you know, it really shows you how they were trying to use genetics to make sense of heredity. That this was the big question that they were, and others were trying to answer. That quest took them in some very dark and dangerous directions in some cases. And, you know, those are worth bearing in mind today, a century later. You know, just as genetics was this huge revolution in our thinking, I'd argue we're in another revolution of genomics. let's learn those lessons and not make those mistakes.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that comes to my mind recently, and that's just simply because, you know, I've been working as a science communicator for about a decade and then decided last year to go back to school. So I'm, you know, a first year PhD student again, a decade later.
Oh,
what am I thinking? Yeah. And I'm studying clinical psychology and I'm learning things that I never really realized when I was doing my undergrad in psychology, because I took a detour into the neurosciences. And, you know, I did a course last semester on intelligence testing, on cognitive testing, on, you know, administering the WACE. And I dove really deep into early intelligence testing and factor analysis and Pearson and Spearman and, you know, all of these really important kind of guys that were in the IQ movement. And they were all eugenicists. Like, it's so, maybe not Binet, but almost everybody else early on in the movement who were developing these statistical techniques, who were figuring out how to test for IQ, were eugenicists. And that doesn't mean that the modern conception of IQ is eugenicist in nature, but it definitely means that the historical research is steeped in that. And we must understand that. It's not just there was a few bad apples. Let's, you know, make sure that we don't make the same mistake. But it's like, no, this was the architects of this movement were doing it for this purpose. And I think once you realize that, then you start to go, oh, okay, the social ramifications, the sociological effects of this are lasting and they have staying power. And there's a reason that to this day, you know, African Americans generally score a standard deviation lower than white Americans on most IQ tests. It's not because their standard deviation stupider. It's because these tests were developed for white people by white people.
Yeah, and I think that another important issue is we can't pretend that people had these ideas about eugenics and then just sort of kept their ideas to themselves.
Yeah.
You know, these were people who then were, you know, I write about a psychologist named Henry Goddard. I focus on him. He was in New Jersey, where he really promoted eugenics by focusing on the heredity of feeblemindedness in one woman in particular, who we now know is named Emma Wolverton, but he called her Deborah Kallikak in a book called The Kallikak Family. Hmm. And he used this quote-unquote evidence about Emma Wolverton as part of his campaign to get sterilization laws put in place in more states like New Jersey. And, you know, these laws were passed based on this conception of heredity, and thousands of people got sterilized as a result of it. I talk about in the book how, you know, in Nazi Germany, people would go to the movies and there'd be like a little sort of educational movie brought to them by the government before the main event. And one of these was a movie called Heredity. And in this, they, you know, they talk about the birds and the bees and so on. And then they switch to humans and they say, they show this family tree that Henry Goddard had published of Emma Wolverton, and claiming like this was proof positive that feeblemindedness was, quote unquote, was totally inherited. And therefore that what that meant was we had to keep these people from having children. And in Nazi Germany, you know, that starts with sterilization and then it goes way beyond that into genocide. And it's just, this is what happened. And so to pretend that these were just, you know, ideas that fell out of fashion is just to really underestimate the real impact that they had.
And as a science writer, I mean, a preeminent science writer who has covered so many topics over the course of your career, I'm interested in your take, and maybe I'm venturing a bit here into ethics and morality, but your take on this discussion that you often hear that science is, you know, non-moral, science is non-ethical, doing science for the sake of science and investigating things shouldn't have a moral dimension. We'll leave that up to the ethicists, you know, or scientists should not talk politics. They should just do their work in their lab. I've always been really haunted by that viewpoint. And obviously, this is something that you've written about before. Do you think that it's important that every experiment be done with a sort of moral valence, a moral viewpoint.
Well, I think that might be kind of difficult, you know, to say like, okay, we're doing this, you know, we're going to do this study on this particular molecule, you know, in white blood cells, and we have to have a whole big ethical framework for it, you know. But I do think that, you know, more broadly, I mean, I do think that scientists, you know, need to recognize that they're doing their science in a moral framework. I mean, you know, when a scientist writes a grant app, the application is saying, why should we give you money to do this? In other words, why is this valuable? What is the value here? And then they say like, oh, well, we will learn new things. And, you know, maybe that's because knowledge itself is valuable, or that knowledge could then lead to better treatment. So, you know, giving people better health, that's valuable too. You know, the eugenicists would say, we're going to make society better. You know, we're doing a good thing here because we're going to we're not going to let society just depend on sort of random reproduction. we're going to plan this out based on science. In all those cases, you have people who have values sort of baked into the science that they're doing, the science that they choose to do and why they're doing it.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break from this show to thank a brand new sponsor this week, Molecule, the only air purifier that actually destroys pollutants. So if you've used an air purifier in your home because you suffer from allergies or you have a hard time breathing at night because you've got asthma, your air purifier probably has a HEPA filter, and HEPA works okay. It's old. It's old technology. It's from the 40s. And what it does is it actually like captures up and binds up all of the different particulate matter and volatile chemicals that are in the air. But Molecule is different. It's introducing a breakthrough science that's capable of destroying these air pollutants at a molecular level. It uses something called PECO, which stands for photoelectrochemical oxidation. And it absolutely eliminates the allergens, mold, bacteria, viruses, and different airborne volatile chemicals that can cause discomfort in the air. In fact, one customer said she was able to breathe through her nose for the first time in 15 years. Oh gosh, how sad. It's got a really beautiful design as well. Some people call it the Apple of air purifiers, and it helps you sleep. The research is backed by the EPA. It's been tested and verified by third-party labs like the University of Minnesota Particle Calibration Laboratory, the University of South Florida Center for Biological Defense, and of course, the inventor, Dr. Yogi Goswami, has published multiple studies on this technology. So guys, you know, this is effective. It's verified by science. And it's tested by real people. It's helped allergy and asthma sufferers around the country better cope with their conditions, significantly reduce their symptoms. And you, the Talk Nerdy listeners, get to try it now for $75 off your first order. So go to molecule.com and at checkout, enter the promo code NERDY. Again, that's MOLEKULE. Molecule.com and enter the promo code NERDY. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Is there a modern version of eugenics? I mean, is there a veiled version now, or are we at risk with some of the new science coming out of heredity and genetics of backtracking into that world?
I don't see anything that's currently happening along those lines. And so, and you know, there's always a challenge when you're trying to look into the future that you're not sure whether you're really looking at plausible futures or if you are just, you know, indulging in science fiction. You know?
Yeah.
So I can tell you a story, you know, like, well, in 2050, you know, the Chinese government decided that they were going to improve their economic output by creating, you know, a whole new generation of children with genetic modifications that would enhance their cognition. And, you know, I can already see the movie trailer, but but I don't really know if I would bet my house that that was actually going to happen. That would be like a government-led, social policy-driven kind of eugenics. And that's kind of, that's kind of what people were talking about 100 years ago. What's interesting is now that what people are thinking about a lot is maybe there is a sort of a marketplace-driven, individual consumer-based, maybe not eugenics, but, you know, just people, you know, maybe people will want to pay money for their own children to be altered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do think that we are that possibility is like very close, because you just need to look at, first of all, the science that's already in place. And second of all, what are people doing? So if there are people now who have, say, something like Huntington's disease, and so there's a gene, they carry a defective copy of a gene that causes them to have this disease, and they want to have children, and they don't want their children to have this disease. So they do in vitro fertilization, and then they use genetic testing to basically determine which embryos carry that mutation and which don't, and then they only use the ones that don't.
Mm-hmm.
So they're... maybe they're not directly modifying the DNA, but they're making a choice that, you know, really does have a huge impact on the child that is born out of that. You know, if that's not eugenics, it's close to it. But I don't see a lot of people objecting to that, because it's a very intimate personal thing having to do with a fatal disease.
Yeah, it seems like there are two things at play here. There's the dimensionality. Is this about preventing pain and suffering, or is this about improving somebody's kind of chances in life and giving them an edge up? And then on the flip side of that, is somebody else trying to kind of force this upon the family, or is it the family's decision? And yeah, this example that you give happens to fall on kind of the safe part of the grid, right? Like the part where it's the family's choice and they're just trying to prevent suffering. And you see it too with, you know, a mom might get pregnant and she has, you know, after testing, she realizes that her fetus will have Down syndrome. And then she has a choice early on in the pregnancy, a choice that nature might make for her, or a choice that she may choose to make medically.
Right. I mean, if we start saying like, well, these things are unnatural, then that kind of critique could apply to all sorts of kind of interventions that we do all the time.
It's actually a fallacy, right? The appeal to nature fallacy. Like, just because something's natural does not imply that it is good, and or vice versa.
Right. And our conception, I mean, I don't mean to be relativistic about this, but the fact is that our feelings about what is good and what is not change with time and with exposure to things. And, you know, vaccines, for example, like when they were introduced in Boston, there were riots in the 1700s. And then, you know, for the most part, vaccines came to be very much accepted. Now we're having this shift in some communities to hostility again about them, that they're not good. When I was talking about CRISPR with scientists, I had a very interesting conversation with a Nobel laureate, Craig Mello, at the University of Massachusetts, and he's getting into CRISPR research and you know, CRISPR pharmaceutical-based, you know, medical treatments. And he said, you know, I bet you that in 50 years, we're going to look at CRISPR-like vaccination. Why wouldn't you do this? How could you not give your child these kinds of benefits that we can give?
Yeah, interesting.
It's a provocative way of thinking about it.
But so much of that has to do with democratization, right? So much of it has to do with, is it available to everybody? Can people who are impoverished or people who don't have the means still have access to these tools? Because it does seem that a lot of the moral framework around it comes from the fact that some people can do it, and some people, and who those people are, is societally influenced. Some people can't, right? That's where the kind of real sort of eugenics, the dirtiness of eugenics seems to come into play.
You know, it does, you know, in a certain context. I mean, so in the United States, you know, we have healthcare that is you know, largely driven in terms of access by how much money you have. And so, you know, we could definitely be concerned like, oh, if CRISPR, you know, gene editing could provide big benefits to people in the future, and we can debate that too. if it does give these big benefits, then it's only going to go to the people who can afford to do it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's true. If the only way to do it is you have to go to a private company and pay them $50,000, but that has more to do with, you know, the health system in a country than the technology. You could just as easily imagine, let's say, Sweden. Okay, and with socialized medicine, if for some reason they decided that it would be you know, beneficial for public health and you know, sort of the public expenditures to offer CRISPR to parents, whoever wanted it, for free, then all of a sudden this discussion about the haves and have-nots evaporates. And then we're sort of left with saying like, well, is just doing this period ethically acceptable?
That's true. And that's like a more kind of core fundamental question. Just like, I mean, I love the vaccine analogy that you brought up, because of course, there's still people to this day who don't have access to vaccines, but vaccines are significantly cheaper than they used to be. And there are, you know, massive kind of nonprofits and big pushes towards bringing these vaccines. Poliovirus, I think, is a perfect example, where it's almost completely eradicated for many reasons. It's the type of thing that we can eradicate. A lot of other things we can't. But we're at a place now with, because of the pushes that we've seen, we may be polio free here within the next decade or so, which is just incredible. And maybe you're right. Maybe we'll be at a place where we're, you know, there nary again is a case of Huntington's or Tay-Sachs or any of these genetic diseases that, people are already really wary of and already working really hard to screen out because they can be so devastating for the individual and the family.
Yeah. And just to sort of jump in about again, with the vaccine parallel, I mean, think about it this way, that, I mean, for a long time, there was better vaccine coverage in richer countries than in poorer ones, you know?
Yeah.
Countries like the United States eradicated smallpox, you know, a lot sooner than in India or Ethiopia, for example. So, but the medical community did not look at that disparity and say, well, this is terrible. These vaccines are terrible. This is so unjust. So let's just not use vaccines.
Yeah.
We just need to sort of like build up a sort of infrastructure that can deliver these vaccines to everybody. And then everybody benefits, because once smallpox is gone, it's not going to, you know, hopefully will not, you know, roar back and ignore international boundaries. So when people sort of brush away all discussion about CRISPR and heredity, I just think like, well, you know, I just don't really think that logically it works that way. It's more complicated than that.
Totally. It's just throwing the baby out with the bathwater completely, which is the worst simile. Is that a simile? No, that's a metaphor. I don't know. That's an adage. I don't know. But yeah, it's a terrible thing to do. And you're right. CRISPR is much more similar, or at least the outcome of CRISPR, to a poliovirus or a smallpox, one of these things that's not a spillover infection, right? One of these things where once it's gone, it's gone. It's gone. And CRISPR would work similarly to that, because we're talking about genes that are carried by people. So once those genes just, or the mutations just don't exist anymore, they're gone until somebody has another natural mutation again to produce them, which is, I don't know, it's fascinating. So let's talk about CRISPR for a minute, because
sure.
I think most of the people listening to Talk Nerdy know about CRISPR. We've talked about it a lot on the show, but you are just like such a good science writer, science communicator. You bring such clarity to these sometimes really complicated issues. So maybe you can just take a moment to describe what CRISPR is and what its real potential could be.
Sure. So CRISPR is basically a gene editing technology. So what you can do is you can basically design a probe, a little molecular probe, that is going to be able to zoom around an entire genome inside a cell and home in on just one particular sequence of DNA. And, mm-hmm. and then it can bring with it a sort of molecular scissors that will snip out that section of DNA. And then you can actually then just plug in a new little section of DNA to replace that part. So it works kind of like a search and replace function in a Microsoft Word document when it's working well.
And so this, I mean, I know, I guess I'm interested in your take as somebody who's written about this and who reads a lot of research that comes across your desk. Do you think we're in an era of like CRISPR mania, kind of like microbiome mania? Like, do you think this is something where people are overly excited and it may not live up to the hype? Or are you actually one of the people who's like, man, CRISPR, like this is going to be big. This is a super game changer.
Well, I do think it's going to be a game changer in a lot of different areas, but that doesn't necessarily mean it is going to do everything everywhere. So there is some hype. You know, sometimes when I read some claims about what CRISPR is going to do, I sort of raise my eyebrow like, oh, really? Like, is there any evidence of that at all? but, you know, you don't have to go far to see a lot of really impressive evidence. For example, with crops, you can use CRISPR to make very precise, quick changes to plant genes. And this is more sophisticated than sort of traditional genetic engineering with crops. You know, when, for example, people might pull in a gene from another species and just plunk it into plant cells. Here you're saying, well, if we just tweak this little part of this gene so that it affects mm-hmm. the timing of when the gene turns on and turns off, we can trigger very powerful changes in exactly how we want them. And so I've talked to scientists and visited them in their greenhouses where they're trying to basically turn wild plants into domesticated crops in one shot, basically in one generation. They think they can do it, basically by combining a bunch of different CRISPR changes to these wild plants and doing it on a rational basis, saying like, well, I need this plant to grow fruit and hold on to it longer. I need the fruit to be bigger. I need the fruit to be able to be collected by machinery. Well, there's a CRISPR for that.
Yeah. And it's something that we've been doing, for thousands of years through, like you said, traditional domestication, traditional breeding. And of course, because ever the person who's interested in ethics, there are things in the way. There are governments and powers that be that don't like the idea of genetic modification at all. And so, unfortunately, a lot of these scientists have to do the CRISPR work in the lab and then go back out and traditionally backward breed them to get them where they need to be just to get over that hurdle. Which is annoying, and it's a frustrating step, but they've at least figured out how to hack the system and use GMO for research, but then still give a traditionally bred crop for commercialization. But in countries where it's legal, like the US, to do genetic modification, gosh, like what an important step for so many reasons, for resistance to climate change, resistance to drought, resistance to lowland flooding, like all of these different, improved nutritional content. Like there's all these potentials using CRISPR just in our food supply.
Yeah. And it moves fast. That's the other key thing is that, before it was such a long, laborious process to alter genes, whether in plants or say in a lab mouse, you wanted to create a strain of mice to study a disease. Mm-hmm. Some poor grad student would have to spend a year or more just to see if their modifications actually worked. And if they didn't, they have to go back to scratch. But now, bang, all of a sudden, in a matter of days or weeks, you have put in the changes that you want, and it's cheap and generally quite accurate. So I do think it's a game changer in a lot of different ways. It may not live up to quite all the hype that people are making, but that has more to do with, the human applications.
I'm just thinking about how frustrating it must be to be. There's probably somebody listening right now who got their degree in genetics or in, plant domestication, something husbandry, like 30 years ago and went through all of that. And now they're like cursing the gods, seeing how easy it is.
Yeah. It is.
Like, oh man, if only I had gone to school in the, you know.
I imagine them like, you know, waving their fists at grad students saying, in my day, we had to, and just, yeah. But, you know, I try to explain to my kids what it was like using a typewriter, and they just look at me blankly. It's the same thing. CRISPR is like, you know, a computer of genetic engineering.
Oh, that's true. And before the typewriter, people had to hand write things. Terrible.
Impossible.
Oh, and dip the little quill in the ink, re-ink it every time. Yeah, it gets bad. So, okay, we mentioned, because I'm going to have to, we're going to have to jump off soon, and there's, so many things that we could potentially talk about, but we did kind of mention the word epigenetics. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't come back to it. Do you think that this, like, obviously, it's a real area of research, but in lots of at least science writing and reporting, it has sort of a buzzword nature to it. Do you think epigenetics is living up to its hype? Because this is something we've known about now for quite a while, and it's something that has always had this kind of mystical, I don't know, this magical connotation to it.
Well, I don't think it's fair to burden scientists who are doing research on epigenetics with the crazy headlines that
Yeah.
some newspaper editor wrote. you know, I mean, unless a scientist herself or himself says, you know, Lamarck is right and epigenetics is all and it's a new form of heredity, then, you know, I think I'm willing to cut scientists some slack. But I do think that for reasons I'm still not entirely clear about, epigenetics really has grabbed hold of the popular imagination. You can take classes in epigenetic yoga. There are, I'm not kidding.
Oh, no.
I'll let you Google it on your own, but... Yes.
Hello, pseudoscience.
Yeah. And so it's just not, I mean, but the fact is that epigenetics is a really incredibly important and fascinating area of research. The problem is that with the challenge, I should say, is that it's hard to explore the ways that cells turn their genes on and off and really come to really solid, definitive conclusions about how it all works. Even simple questions about cause and effect can be surprisingly hard to pin down when you do research in epigenetics. And part of the problem may be that the studies up till now have been very small and that, you know, epigenetics researchers just have to step up their game and they need to, instead of studying 10 mice, study 1,000 mice and, you know, to really get strong statistical results.
So before, I guess, before we dive into these kind of final few moments, maybe we should take just a minute to break down, you know, what epigenetics is and where some of that mismatch comes in between what's happening in the lab and what's kind of reported by maybe some of the more extreme headlines out there.
Sure. And I mean, I should just preface this by saying that, you know, even the word epigenetics is very contested among scientists. It's got a long, messy history. So if I start talking about epigenetics, I'm sure at least some scientists will pull their hair out. So I apologize.
Yeah.
But basically, epigenetics is the study of how molecules around genes keep them turned on and off. In other words, some genes are going to be active and cells are going to use them to make proteins and other molecules, and others are going to be kept silent. And you can keep a gene silent by basically coiling it up and just sort of tucking it away. You can cover parts of it with certain molecules known as methyl groups. And these changes can be very long lasting. So like if a cell grows and divides and makes two new sets of DNA, those two new sets will have the same epigenetic marks on them. And that's very important because that means that, you know, when your skin cells are growing and dividing, they're still skin. You know, you don't want to suddenly be sprouting, you know, teeth on the back of your hand or something. So that's the basics of epigenetics. And so then So in a way, that's its own kind of heredity. If you think about heredity as just cells dividing and daughter cells inheriting, not just genes, but the epigenetics, that's definitely real.
And this is something we see, I often hear this in context or in reference to like famine. You know, an entire group of people are subjected to like less nutritional density, and then their children are actually physically smaller.
So the thing is that experience can affect epigenetics. You know, like if you starve, it's not going to just suddenly change all of your genes. But it is possible for, you know, at least conceivably, for it to change the methyl groups or that coiling of your DNA. And that can have an effect on how your genes actually work. So same genes working in a different way, thanks to experience. Now, the big question is, when those people who survived that famine have kids, are they going to pass down these sort of long-lasting epigenetic effects to their kids?
And how many generations would that go if it did go?
Right. And the evidence for this is called transgenerational epigenetic inheritance, and there's really good evidence in plants.
And we are not plants.
Yeah, we're not plants. So, you know, I think it's really cool. And I talk in the book about some amazing stories about plants that Linnaeus studied and was totally baffled by them because they had these weird epigenetic effects. He called them monsters. That's the name he gave them.
Wow.
And they're still monsters today. And it's just epigenetics carried on for over 200 years. But, you know, when you get into animals and particularly into humans, the evidence gets a lot squishier, a lot less reliable. And there's a lot more intense debate about whether it really means anything. But that's what we care about most. So we're in this funny situation.
Yeah. And of course, I think an important point to make, and you mentioned it before, is that we're not talking about Lamarckianism or Lamarckism, I don't know how to say it, that we are not talking about this idea of bringing back these kind of debunked views or hypotheses about how genetics, or I should just say about how evolution works. And we obviously don't have time to dive into the difference between what Lamarck thought and what Darwin thought. But you can look that up, you guys, if you haven't read all about it. So Carl, I know that it's almost time to go, but I know that my, listeners would be so pissed if I didn't ask you the final two questions that I ask everybody who comes on the show, because I think that your perspective is just such an important one. It's such a special one. And it's one that's really, I think, influenced the public understanding of science in a way that a much deeper way than I'm sure most of my listeners really know. So here they are, and they're big picture questions. So be ready for that if you don't mind. Throw them at you right now. So I want you to think about the future, and I want you to think about it in whatever context has been on your mind recently. Maybe it's shaped by the book that you just wrote. Maybe it is shaped by your own personal experiences, your family, big global issues, you know, whatever. When you think about the future, the first question is, what is the thing that you really are preoccupied by? What is keeping you up at night? If you had to pick one thing, what are you, you know, bummed out about, like feeling not very optimistic about? But then on the flip side of that, you know, so we end on a positive note, what are you really hopeful for, optimistic about? Like, what are you honestly kind of excited that the vistas of the future will bring for us?
Well, it's interesting, you know, when you talk about the future, I mean, that's a big element of my book, because when we think about heredity, we're thinking about the past handing things down to the future. And, you know, I think about, you know, my own kids, they were born at a time when, you know, the atmosphere was different than when I was born. You know, there's a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now and than there was then. And their kids will probably, you know, if things keep going the way they're going, their kids will, if they have them, will inherit an atmosphere with even more carbon dioxide in it. So I just see climate change as being one of those just gigantic issues of civilization, simply because it's going to be affecting us for so many few generations into the future. I mean, if we were just to stop producing any carbon dioxide right now, you know, the planet would still have these elevated levels for centuries or thousands of years, and would also have a substantially warmer climate than it would otherwise. I mean, we're effectively like putting off the ice age right now. And
yeah,
so, you know, that's heavy because like, that affects us in so many different ways and
ways we can't even predict. I mean, we've gotten good at modeling most of the things that could happen, but there's stuff we can't even imagine as a result of this.
Yeah. You know, like, I talk to ecologists and they talk about how species are rushing around and as a result of climate change, and they're producing what ecologists are calling novel ecosystems. That means there's nothing that exists now or that exists in the fossil record that they can compare to these ecosystems that are taking shape now. What's going to happen? We don't know. But, you know, in the book, I sort of argue that, you know, we need to think about these issues in terms of heredity, but not genetic heredity. Like we need to think of them culture as a kind of heredity. Yeah. And a culture that we humans can build on our culture generation to generation. And that's how we domesticated crops. That's how civilizations arose. That's how the Industrial Revolution took off, was being able to inherit this knowledge and these customs from our ancestors and then building on that and then passing that down. You know, unfortunately, that also changed the environment in the process so that there's this environmental heredity. But if climate change is ultimately an issue of cultural heredity, we can change culture. You know, I'd argue that we have a better shot at changing culture than we do of, you know, rewriting the genes of everybody on Earth. So I'm all for playing around with heredity if it's cultural heredity.
Nice. And is that what you is that the flip side of the question? Is that one of the things you're really looking forward to? And you think that could have a good positive benefit really globally?
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, I just look at people, you know, look at teenagers and people in their 20s, and they have a different attitude about climate change. I think that people in older generations either said, well, this couldn't possibly happen, or then they immediately switch to saying, oh my God, it's happening and there's nothing we can do, you know, as we continue to drive to work in gas guzzlers. So
yeah,
I do sense a shift. As a science writer, when I started out, I would write about climate change from time to time in the 1990s. And it was like, you know, we were just doing it and it seemed like nobody was really paying attention. And you talk about global warming and people give you a blank look. But now everybody knows about it. Even if there's a lot of skepticism or denialism about climate change in the United States, there's still a whole lot of people who just sort of understand the basics of it and understand what a threat it represents. And that kind of shift, I like.
Me too. Well, Carl, oh my gosh, I have to thank you so much for joining me. Guys, the book is She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity, and of the airing of this episode. It is out already. I highly recommend you pick it up. Carl, this is so much fun. I wish we could have talked for like three more hours. I've got to thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.